Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad airport, and lately they are violating it by assassination of Iraqi resistance commanders.
Kataib Hezbollah also warned that any removal of leaders of popular mobilization units must be decided by the PMU internally. It says acting otherwise would be a significant mistake.
Our government has made it clear on multiple occasions that the need for U.S. military forces have ended. Our security forces are capable of running the country's security system and face any threat. Washington is clearly trying to rally around the negotiations, and it is a clear attempt to delay their withdrawal from the country.
In January, the Iraqi resistance decided to halt the attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria. The attacks were started on October 19 in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Observers say that the suspension was to allow a climate of serenity for talks between Baghdad and Washington over the U.S. military presence. But as some have rightly noted, Washington has no intention to change its behavior in Iraq.
It is obvious that Washington is trying to gain more time to keep its military presence in Iraq. Our government needs to push forward and speed up the pace of negotiations to end the presence of these foreign forces and save our country's political, economic, and social stability.
On paper, the U.S. military forces are present in the country for advisory purposes, as well as training the Iraqi forces to fight Daesh terrorist group. However, in practice, the U.S. forces have shown a different objective by violating Iraqi sovereignty, attacking PMU positions, and killing top Iraqi commanders. Since the start of their operations in October, the resistance in Iraq has been pushing the government to end the U.S. military presence in the country. Also, they have time and again reiterated their solidarity with Palestinians. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24, a national day of mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through their agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Syrians used to say, no one sleeps hungry, but that was 13 years before the devastating terrorist war that was waged upon them, the war that has pushed many Syrians below the poverty line. SAID is an association that has been helping these people by providing daily meals to the needy during the fasting month for over a decade. Despite the increasing challenges, they are determined to continue with their mission.
We're currently operating a kitchen called Hunger Be Gone. Unfortunately, our resources this year are less than previous years due to the circumstances the country has been through, such as the earthquake disaster that drained a lot of financial resources. We distribute around 200 to 250 meals every day to the people who come to the association, while our motorcycle team also delivers meals to remote areas.
As a chef, I start every day at 9 a.m. by preparing the water and cooking the chicken for the scheduled meal. I have been volunteering for 5 years to help my fellow countrymen in these difficult circumstances.
Syrians have demonstrated their sense of responsibility in various ways during this crisis, particularly during the month of Ramadan. The Holy Month of Mercy encourages people to be selfless and to help alleviate the sufferings of others. Voluntary work is one of the ways through which Syrians showcase their contributions to society.
So we are here not only to donate financially, but to donate our time. More specifically, volunteering is something very important, especially for our generation. We need to teach people that giving doesn't always mean that you need to take something in return. So we're here to volunteer with our time, to try to help people as much as we can. So Sa'ad Association is our vessel to do that.
Today we came to make meals for the people in need. First we cut the vegetables, then we shredded the chicken. And now we are cooling down the rice and the chicken. Then we're going to put it in boxes and give it to people in need.
Despite the United States' theft of their resources and the inhuman sanctions imposed upon them, which have put Syrians in dire living conditions, they steadfastly hold on to their love for their country. United against all the odds, they strive to find their way through this dark tunnel towards the dawn of a brighter life.
Syrians have always firmly stood together, not only against terrorism, but also in the face of unjust Western sanctions, through voluntary initiatives that show their love to each other and to their homeland. Ibrahim Wahid, Damascus.
Since the Al-Aqsa flood operation and the Israeli genocidal aggression against Gaza began early October last year, Hezbollah has taken a stance of defense against Israeli military targets near Lebanon's southern border. Now, months later, a propaganda campaign has been launched against such efforts, with social media posts and bulletin boards across the Lebanese capital Beirut and beyond reading slogans such as "Implementing international resolutions enhances stability" or "Lebanon does not want war."
If you asked all Lebanese whether they would want an Israeli war to begin in Lebanon, the unanimous response would be no, especially with decades of experience with the Israeli regime and its disproportionate targeting of civilians. Yet what seems like a simple billboard has deeper implications for a country like Lebanon. Experts tell Press TV that certain groups in Lebanon have launched this campaign to put people against the resistance at a time of war. But are these factions working alone?
This campaign, we can say that it doesn't represent the Lebanese people. And especially in that it is, and we have informations, it is funded by foreign countries.
Those parties and those factions, they were controlled by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. The U.S. Ambassador, Dorshi Shea, as she was departing Beirut and also receiving her successor, Lisa Johnson, they were working on this in a way that would, help Amos Hochstein and his pressures put on Lebanon.
Hochstein, who is an Israeli-American businessman and lobbyist, has gone back and forth from Beirut to Tel Aviv in attempts to stop the resistance operations, without any mention of an end to Israeli violations of Lebanon's rights, which have persisted for over 17 years.
By supporting the resistance in Gaza or in Palestine, the resistance in Lebanon have prevented war. It didn't start the war. And especially when the Lebanese people and the Palestinian people and the Iraqi people and all people in the world are not protected by the international decisions.
Some people inside Lebanon, they are working as agents of the Americans and the Zionists, unfortunately, trying to accuse Hezbollah and the resistance of false things, misinformation, though It is crystal clear that the resistance is trying to protect Lebanon.
With growing popular support and despite the pressure from foreign and domestic sides, Hezbollah has been adamant on proceeding with its supportive military operations as long as the Israeli onslaught against Gaza continues. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The celebration of Nowruz and the arrival of the Persian year of 1403 was held at the Rome residence of the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Italy, a well-laid aft-seen table bearing seven auspicious items starting with the letter S was put out as the guests, mostly Iranian expats and Italians, were welcoming the first day of the new year and the arrival of spring.
Nowruz is much more than a tradition, it is a culture. Nowruz symbolizes the victory of good over evil, the balance of the spring. Nowruz means to lay all grievances aside and to celebrate family ties and friendship. Nowruz is a time for peace and reconciliation. It is a time for cleaning our homes.
The embassy's Nowruz celebration ceremony included a feast of Iranian food, followed by vibrant traditional music. Millions of people across the world celebrate Nowruz and its traditional rituals that emphasize the values of peace, solidarity, and goodwill towards all. 25,000 Iranians currently residing in Italy are among those who celebrate the Persian New Year.
I'm from Tehran. I've been living in Italy for 40 years. Even though we are far away from our homeland, we were all waiting for the Nowruz celebrations. It's really important for us because that's where our roots lie.
Io sono Gaudia, sono italiana.
My name is Gaudia and I'm Italian. I've been married to an Iranian man for 49 years. The Nowruz tradition has become a part of my life. I love celebrating nature and renewal in nature, and I'm proud that I'm passing on this wonderful tradition to my grandchildren.
People at the gathering share the same belief that it is important to embrace Nowruz's universal message of renewal and unity, and that its celebration is also an opportunity to reflect on the past year, nurture new hopes, and celebrate the continuous cycle of life. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of people have engaged in a 41-kilometer pilgrimage, symbolically depicting the length of the Gaza Strip and a trek that scores of Palestinians have been forced to make due to the US-backed Israeli campaign of genocide against them. The event has been organized by a collective of Christian bodies. The organizers say it is important to demonstrate that Christian Zionism does not represent them.
The church has been very complicit within this genocide and within Palestinian suppression more generally, and because of that is not condemning what they're doing, is not recognizing what they're doing as ethnic cleansing and genocide, and not speaking out. And we wanted to challenge that narrative and challenge that stance and show an expression of solidarity, show that that's not the only thing coming out of the church.
The demonstration also coincides with South Africa's commemoration of the Sharpeville massacre, when the apartheid regime gunned down 69 protesters in what is recognized as a turning point in the struggle for liberation. For those who participated, the Palestinian suffering resonates deeply.
And what I saw today in my own, as I walked, you know, because it's a pilgrimage, reflecting, I said to myself, I feel my feet, you know, burning. I feel this old legs not moving as it should. But it's nothing in comparison what people are experiencing.
The South African public is still asleep, and they must start waking up to see what Israel is doing. But what they do there, they can also come and do anywhere else in the world.
I'm a proud Jew. I'm not a Zionist, and I never have been. And I think that what the Netanyahu government is doing is actually a moral genocide. Whether they call it illegal, I don't know whether it fits legally, but it's morally a genocide. And I'm appalled. I'm heartbroken. As somebody who's lived through apartheid, we have seen this before. We should know better.
The Gaza ceasefire pilgrimage coincided with the somber Christian period of Lent, and sacrifice and resilience were recurring themes pilgrims pointed to as they attempted to symbolically walk in the footsteps of Gazans.
The Gaza ceasefire march is another example of the human resolve for justice. And as Palestinians endure the latest Israeli aggression for almost 6 months now, the people of the world will only intensify their commitment for Palestinian liberation. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt. Thank you.
Monlay.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome. Now, the only effective and efficient way to deliver heavy goods to meet Gaza's humanitarian needs is by road, and that includes an exponential increase in commercial deliveries. Now, these are not my words, but the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who made the comments during his visit to Egypt on Sunday. He also warned of the impact of Israel's month-long war on Gaza that was having around the world. And this is exactly what we will be talking about in the next half an hour. I am your host, Gisum Shah Ahmadi, and you're watching The Spotlight. And to delve into the issues I just mentioned, we have with us Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, who is joining us from Tehran, and also Ramiro Funes. There he is, Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator who is joining us from Los Angeles.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight. Now, the daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis that is undermining the credibility of the international community in general. The entire world seems to be silent. Mr. Salam from Tehran, what do you have to comment on this one?
The latest massacres are absolutely barbaric. It's incredible to just see what's coming out. It's not just, for example, in the ones that we've seen in the past where they kill a bunch of people flat out. This time they're resorting to very sadistic acts of torture and revenge, specifically in the siege of Al-Shifa Hospital. We've all seen the reports about how they've been raping women, raping pregnant women, beating pregnant women, and then killing some of their victims and forcing the men to watch it. That's, it's one thing when they kill people, which is obviously brutal, but to leave people alive and then to subject them to this kind of physical and psychological torture is absolutely unimaginable. It breaks the human heart into a million pieces. And the fact that they were able to get away with the lie saying that Hamas was the one who did this despite no proof. And in fact, many of the Israeli outlets backing away from their original claims, because not because they care about telling the truth, but because they realized their lies were too absurd to stand the light of day. But this is their sadistic and very satanic sense of revenge. And these types of massacres, as well as the terrorist attack in Moscow, occurred around the time of the holiday of Purim, which is actually a quite racist and genocidal holiday, which basically celebrates the genocide of Persians in the Book of Esther in the Old Testament, where the king of Persia was married to a Jewish queen, and she suspected that one of the people were trying to kill all the Jews, essentially, but turned out that's not the case. But she still ordered basically a mass murder spree of innocent people suspected of being, you know, the enemy of the people of Esther. And so every year this holiday is celebrated, and it's not just extending to Persians. but anybody who they view as their enemy, this is like celebration of revenge. It's very, you know, very, very sick stuff. And it's the invasion of Iraq in 2003 happened around this time. So these types of vengeful acts, these bloody acts, happen to happen around this type of this time of the year. So this is a very sick and twisted army, and their terroristic acts should be condemned by the whole world. And the fact that the international organizations are just sitting there shows how useless they are. No matter what kind of statements they make, a statement is not going to make a difference. The only thing that is really hopeful for the Palestinians to end this absolute nightmare, as I've described, is the armed resistance and their allies in the world.
Well, you're absolutely right, and the whole world recognizes that it is past time to be silent, and there needs to be some effective measure taking place. So let's bring in our guest from Los Angeles to explain and elaborate more on that. As our guest from Tehran just mentioned, we need more than just rhetoric at this point in time. We need some action on the ground. So what do you expect from these international organizations, basically the international community, to do?
Like Brother Ali said, the international organizations are completely useless. The United Nations and a lot of the Western-led multinational institutions are not doing anything to rectify the situation, because they're never going to fundamentally get to the core problem, which is the existence of the settler colonial state of Israel in general. A lot of the dialogue has been presented as two-state solution, or how do we calm down the Israelis? How do we get them to pacify a little bit, to relent from Gaza, to relent from the West Bank expansions? But the problem is Israel in and of itself, the very nature of its existence, the very foundation of its creation, going back to Theodor Herzl and the World Zionist Organization. Just as Ali pointed out very brilliantly as well, the Zionists are very much portrayed as, in Western media at least, they're portrayed as secular, democratic. They're not these crazy religious fanatics as, unfortunately, Muslims are portrayed in Western media. But if we look at the people who are running Israel, they are very much religious fanatics. And a lot of these attacks coincide with Purim, with the Book of Esther, with Ishtar, which is the actual meaning of Esther, Ishtar, which is one of the Canaanite gods that they worship, a fertility goddess, if we go into the avenue. But a lot of this stuff goes deep into their mysticism and their religious extremism. They view Palestinians as animals. They don't see them as human beings. They don't see them as equals who they can coexist with. They see them as obstacles to their complete expansion. At the end of the day, we know that the two blue stripes on the Israeli flags represent the Nile and the Euphrates. They want to expand as much as they can. And for them, they see the Palestinians, the Arab peoples, the Muslim people in general, as the biggest obstacle. Because at the end of the day, the biggest resistance to Israeli Zionism is Islam and the axis of resistance. Because the axis of resistance is firm in its faith, and it rejects the lifestyles and appurtenances of Zionism, of commercial banking, of usury, of loaning money on interest, and all of these horrible things. And it is the Muslims in the axis of resistance that are giving the best fight to Israel, because they are guided by an ideology that promotes humility and subservience to God and fear of God alone. And I think what we're seeing, I'm actually very optimistic about the prospects of change against Israel. It's not going to come from the UN. It's not going to come from the US or Europe. It's going to come from the Ummah. It's going to come from the axis of resistance in actually defeating Israel, not just fighting for a two-state solution, not just ending this current struggle that's going on, but completely and totally freeing Palestine and leaving Israel in the dustbin of history where it belongs.
But that is going to take, just as you mentioned, a very long time. So considering the situation on the ground, what do you think would be the best solution for at least a short-term humanitarian ceasefire to get aid inside the Gaza Strip? Let's see what Mr. Ali Salam from Tehran believes we should be doing.
Well, as our brother Ramiro pointed out, that they want to expand to the Nile and Euphrates, but you see they're so fragile even within the borders that they have. They can't capture the West Bank, so I'm optimistic as well. And they have been militarily humiliated in the past, two times in Lebanon, And even now, we can consider this a big humiliation, because never before has Hamas or the Islamic Resistance in Palestine been able to do these kinds of feats. If they expected anything around the time of last year, they didn't expect something of this magnitude. They wouldn't have expected anything that would have humiliated them, because the battles in the past have just been exchanges of rocket fire and rocket fire on the side of the Palestinians and airstrikes on the side of the Zionist occupation. Perhaps they thought it was going to be something like that. Again, few days cleans up. Now, this is something that has caught them by surprise, nor did they expect Lebanon to get in. I mean, the north is practically empty. There's no people in northern occupied Palestine. And if you look at the statistics of how many so-called Israelis have left Palestine and gone back to where they came from originally, like Europe or America or wherever, and people who say that they won't come back, more and more people are packing the airports and getting out of there. So this will actually eventually break the regime. The global shipping blockade imposed by Yemen, which is making the entire world pay the price for these horrible atrocities. There's at least some sense of justice here, and the optimism that our guest in Los Angeles spoke about. This optimism is that they're paying a price for what they're doing. They're not just standing there killing all these people, raping all these women, and getting away with it. That's the thing that we should be proud about. Is this is the achievement of armed resistance. If it wasn't for this resistance, they would do what they want to do, and they would get away with it. That would be the biggest crime, is that they would get away with it. But now they're paying the price. Eventually, it will break them, and eventually they'll have to declare military defeat, probably their biggest military defeat since 2006 with Lebanon.
Well, Mr. Salam, that is absolutely right. And I believe our guest from Los Angeles also agrees, and I agree as well, that the Israelis are now in a situation where they really have no way to go, and eventually they will be defeated, both on international scale, as far as international community is concerned. And now their true colors have been known to the entire world. So they have been practically defeated on all different fronts. But what I'm more concerned about in our discussion right now is the situation on the ground in Gaza, the situation that our Muslim brothers and sisters have as they desperately need aid to get in. And the trucks are there, the aid is there, but the Israelis won't let the aid in. And I would like to quote Antonio Guterres, who just said that they desperately need what's been promised, but they need a flood of aid, not trickles and not drops. So, Mr. Funes, in your opinion, what can be done to get that humanitarian aid inside? And that would definitely require at least a temporary ceasefire.
I think crucial to this is understanding the geopolitics of Gaza. Gaza has a large coastal front, and access to that coast is very crucial. So if we were to bring aid to Gaza, first and foremost, pressuring Israel to allow other countries, other forces, no matter what political tendency or ideology, to just bring in aid from the coast, because logistically that is the best option. Another option is obviously the elephant in the room, Egypt, which shares a large border and the Rafah crossing with Gaza. But unfortunately, Egypt in many ways has been difficult and has not been cooperating with the movements toward opening the border and allowing Palestinians in and bringing in aid. And it's very much unfortunately compromised by the Zionists. So I think logistically in real time now on the ground, the best situation would be some sort of massive aid delivery through the Mediterranean onto the Gaza coast, because that is its biggest coastline. Perhaps the U.S. mentioned building a pier. Obviously, we don't trust the U.S. in any of their plan, but I don't think the pier in and of itself is a bad idea. I would just like to see other nations or countries be able to be part of that, perhaps China or Russia or Iran, to be able to airlift products and goods and aid through the Mediterranean. But I think definitely Egypt would be a tremendous help, being able to bring aid through the Rafah crossing. But again, unfortunately, Egypt is very much compromised. So I think those are our two best options now. And I think anything that Iran would try to do would be perceived as a threat to Israel. And we know at the end of the day that Israel wants war against Iran. And so it's very much Iranian people want to do more and are doing a lot as it is now. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where We also have to tread lightly and delicately in the region, because any sight of an Iranian, you know, Red Crescent ship or aid from Iran is going to be perceived as they're supporting terrorism and this and that. So I think those are realistically the two probably best options right now, but again, very difficult.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Salam, in your opinion, why do you think attempts for a humanitarian ceasefire, and I'm emphasizing on this ceasefire to be humanitarian in order to get humanitarian aid into Gaza, despite the Geneva Conventions and everything that the Western world is so proud of calling itself the civilized world, why is it so difficult for them to get humanitarian aid inside, and why is this ceasefire so impossible?
This has really exposed their hypocrisy. As you stated, they're very proud of these types of things, their Declaration of Human Rights, Geneva Convention. But we see how it falls apart. We see what it truly means when the rubber meets the road. So, like our guest said, the Egyptians have the capacity. I mean, don't they control their own country? Aren't they a sovereign government? Apparently not. They were one of the first governments to normalize with the Israelis. And they have huge ties to the U.S. In fact, their current leader was installed by the U.S. So we can really, you know, to create a scenario for at least a humanitarian ceasefire, as much as the Israelis will violate those terms, but they're going to be forced to the table. The Israelis will be forced to the table of doing this for the sake of their military defeat. That's what will pressure them. Just as the first ceasefire happened, because they were really getting hit very hard, and they were essentially humiliated. So they have to get hit more and more hard. But I think they don't want to get embarrassed a second time around. They don't want to get like the full embarrassed. Like when the full war ends, they'll be totally embarrassed because they can't guarantee the safety of their illegitimate settlers. But on the diplomatic side, at least when it comes to the untrustworthy Qataris and the untrustworthy Egyptians, we can hope for the equation of the declining and weakening U.S. and the increasing strength of Iran, and to a lesser extent, Russia and China, because Iran is the most bold in support of Palestine compared to the latter two, who do not exert to the full capacity that they could exert, but still better than what the position of the West is. And in fact, we see this in the agreement that Ansarullah of Yemen has had with Russia and China, and that basically, Russia and China will have no problem with Ansarullah. And Ansarullah, because the Russian and Chinese ships are not participating in this genocide, they let the free flow of Russian and Chinese in any ship that's not participating in this genocide. They act like Ansarullah is a threat to all global trade. No, they're very specific in who that they are targeting. Anybody else who's engaging in ethical business, free to go. So the pressure of this, I think this increasing political relations will allow Iran the diplomatic strength to basically push Qatar and Egypt and these other countries in a certain direction. Now, these countries will always be corrupt. They were born out of Sykes-Picot. They were born out of British colonialism and Zionism. But in their lust for power and their lust to want to stay in power and to be relevant in the region, they're going to have to move a little bit and play a little bit of ball with Iran in order to survive politically in the future. So the hope is in the increasing diplomatic strength of Iran, coinciding with the increasing weakness of the United States.
And we don't have much time left, so Mr. Funes, let's focus more on the situation in Gaza right now. The north of Gaza is practically cut off, so even if there is humanitarian aid in Gaza, it will not reach the northern parts of Gaza. Famine is looming there for the people who are still there, stuck in that region. And also, the situation in Al-Shifa Hospital is really terrible. It's something that is completely appalling. So but what do you think will take the international community to do something to isolate Israel to the point where it will have, out of at least fear of isolation on the international scale, to back off?
I think what will work the best in terms of isolating Israel and bringing international attention and solidarity with northern Gaza will be breaking the spell and the idea that Israel is somehow a victim. This is one of the main ways that Zionism functions. It portrays Israel and the Zionist settlers as victims who are defending themselves, who are just trying to survive, who are trying to build a democracy and a stable economy in the region. And these crazy people just woke up one day and attacked them for no reason. And they perpetrate the spell in mainstream media. They perpetrate the spell in academia. We see all over in the Western academic institutions, people getting fired for being in any way remotely pro-Palestine. And the dominance of Zionism over the major institutions of influence, of media, of real estate, of banking, of all of these key institutions, the commanding heights of the economy, this is crucial to their power. So as long as they control that, they're going to distract people, they're going to misinform people, and they're going to, most importantly, make people afraid to call out Zionism, because if you in any way call it out, then you're somehow anti-Semitic. So crucial to that, just as Brother Ali mentioned earlier, is destabilizing the Israeli economy once they are no longer able to maintain their grip over those key institutions and commanding heights. Once we see the emergence of Iran, Russia, China, and the BRICS global economy as the alternative that is not dependent on Zionist usury, then we can begin to see the destabilization of the Israeli economy. And then these institutions will have more freedom to criticize, to actually bring and promote aid for Gaza and to change the reality on the ground. But I think right now, one of the main issues is that the Zionist media is making it seem that if you're bringing aid to Gaza, you're promoting terrorism. And thus they're going to accuse anybody of doing that as supporting terrorism abroad. So once we are able to weaken the Israel lobby from within, weaken their economy, and actually create an alternative, then it's going to be a lot helpful. I know it sounds very long-term and idealistic, but that's just unfortunately one of the realities that we have to face with today. But first and foremost, I think the actions of Ansar Allah, of the Axis of Resistance, in cutting world trade and blocking that trade and calling for immediate tension, I think that's the best that we can do. Direct action leads to direct change. And unfortunately, that's what's going to have to take for Israel to understand. They only understand strength, and you have to respond to strength with strength.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Funes. Whatever happens at this point in time in history, we do know that right now the armed resistance of the resistance front actually is now very justified by the entire international community. I would have loved to continue this discussion with Mr. Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us live from Tehran, and Ramiro Funes, activist and commentator from Los Angeles. But that's all the time that we have, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Spotlight.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. in the limelight.
In the United States, Judge Scott McAfee is allowing Donald Trump and his election interference co-defendants to appeal an order denying the disqualification of Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis from the case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. A Georgia judge on Wednesday, 20th of March, greenlit an effort by former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants to appeal the decision to allow Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis to continue to prosecute the 2020 election subversion case there. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee, who ruled last week against the defendants' efforts to disqualify Fannie Willis, has issued a certificate of immediate review, allowing the case to be reviewed by a Georgia appeals court. Judge Scott McAfee wrote, "The issue is of such importance to the case that immediate review should be had. The move doesn't pause the prosecution but allows appeals on the disqualification effort to play out before trial. It is now up to the Georgia Court of Appeals to review the decision not to disqualify Fannie Willis and decide if it wants to take up the case." While Judge Scott McAfee's ruling last week allowed Fannie Willis to stay on the case, it forced the resignation of her top deputy on the case, Nathan Wade. Donald Trump and his co-defendants have argued that a romantic relationship between Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade created a conflict of interest that should disqualify both of them. Steve Sado, the lead defense counsel for Donald Trump in the case, called Wednesday's motion by Judge Scott McAfee highly significant. The defense is optimistic that appellate review will lead to the case being dismissed and the district attorney being disqualified, Steve Sado said in a statement. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered the same story. Georgia judge Scott McAfee is allowing Donald Trump and his election interference co-defendants to appeal an order denying the disqualification of Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis from the case. In a Wednesday, 20th of March certificate of immediate review, Judge McAfee found that the defendant's order asking to review his decision to keep Fannie Willis on the racketeering case is of such importance to the case that immediate review should be had. Last week, Judge Scott McAfee ruled that while Fannie Willis's romantic relationship with then-special prosecutor Nathan Wade had the significant appearance of impropriety, it could be resolved if one of them stepped aside from the case. Nathan Wade resigned just hours later, allowing Fannie Willis to continue leading the team prosecuting Donald Trump and others for allegedly trying to upend the Georgia 2020 election results. The challenge order is not one of final judgment, and the state has informed the court that it has complied with the order's demands, Judge McAfee wrote on Wednesday. He added that the court intends to continue addressing the many other unrelated pending pretrial motions, regardless of whether the petition is granted within 45 days of filing, and even if any subsequent appeal is expedited by the appellate court. The Georgia Court of Appeals could still decline to hear the case. If that happens, defense lawyers could ask the state Supreme Court to hear the appeal. The criminal case against Donald Trump and his co-defendants will continue as this process happens, though no trial date has been set. The defense is optimistic that appellate review will lead to the case being dismissed and the district attorney being disqualified, Steve Sado, who is representing Donald Trump in Georgia, said in a statement to the Daily Beast. In a Monday motion, eight defendants in the election fraud case considered to be the strongest against Donald Trump had asked Judge Scott McAfee to allow a review of his ruling on Fannie Willis. In its order, the court found that District Attorney Willis's actions had created an appearance of impropriety and an odor of mendacity that lingers in this case, as well as the continuing possibility that an outsider could reasonably think that District Attorney Fannie Willis is not exercising her independent professional judgment totally free of any compromising influences, the Monday motion states. It added that a review is both prudent and warranted because there is a lack of guidance from the appellate courts on key issues. In Judge McAfee's ruling, he did not hold back his opinion that the relationship between Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis was improper and demanded some structural changes in the prosecution team. But he also denied the defense's January motion request to remove Fannie Willis because she misused her power and personally benefited from hiring Nathan Wade as a special prosecutor, stating that there is no evidence of an actual conflict of interest brought on by the relationship. This finding is by no means an indication that the court condones this tremendous lapse in judgment or the unprofessional manner of the district attorney's testimony during the evidentiary hearing, the judge wrote in his Friday ruling. Rather, it is the undersigned's opinion that Georgia law does not permit the finding of an actual conflict for simply making bad choices, even repeatedly, and it is the trial court's duty to confine itself to the relevant issues and applicable law properly brought before it. Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis confirmed during an evidentiary hearing last month that they had a relationship from early 2022 until last summer. The two denied any wrongdoing and pushed back on claims that their affair was funded solely by Nathan Wade. USA Today has also covered this story and tells us more. Lawyers for Donald Trump and seven co-defendants filed an emergency appeal on Monday, 18th of March, of a Georgia judge's decision allowing Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis to stay on the sweeping election fraud case against the former president. They contend the ruling doesn't go far enough by just forcing out Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade admitted to having an affair, but contended that Willis did not improperly benefit from having hired Nathan Wade to oversee the case against Donald Trump and 14 others accused of illegally conspiring to overturn the 2020 election in Georgia. Trump lawyer Stephen Sado said the nine are seeking to disqualify Fannie Willis and the entire district attorney's office, which was the basis of an initial motion filed with Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee on 8th of January. The defendants alleged that Fannie Willis had a clandestine affair with Nathan Wade, the private lawyer she hired to manage the case, and took vacations with him that created a professional conflict of interest. Judge Scott McAfee let Fannie Willis stay on the case as long as she forced out Nathan Wade to preclude any appearance of a conflict of interest going forward.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli forces kill scores of Palestinian civilians in new massacres in Gaza as a death toll from the regime's genocide tops 32,400. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution reaffirms Islamic Republic's unwavering support for Palestine and the people of Gaza.